Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. Joining me for this episode, and I'm sorry it's taken this long to get around to including him in this, is Brad from Our Sweet Mystery Blog. Brad, welcome to In Gad We Trust.
It's so nice to be back in London, even if it's just virtual, JJ.
So what are we talking about today, Brad?
So as soon as the shutdown began here, I tried to figure out, well, what am I going to do with myself? And of course, I had to approach the 750 books on my TBR pile. And I thought, you know, that's why these were written in the first place. Between the wars, golden age detective fiction was written to calm us down with all the uncertainty and the sacrifice that people were making. The idea that there was so much going on in the world around them that they couldn't control. Why not take a couple of hours and relax and be a part of a nightmarish world that does resolve itself in a positive way? And so I wrote something about that on my blog and said, go read a murder mystery. And my friend Cheryl started asking me for suggestions, and I got her reading Helen McCloy. I got her reading Christiana Brand. And now she is zipping through Gideon Fell. You'd be so proud. I thought, why don't we offer this service to the world, to the millions of people who listen to your podcast and who could tell, you know, we can tell them why it's important. It's not just good, but it's important. It's necessary to read golden age detective stories during the COVID crisis.
This sounds like a manifesto I'm hoping a lot of people are able to get behind. That sounds very cool. Five ways that we think golden age detective fiction helps you prepare for the current lockdown crisis, or is going to help you manage your way through the current lockdown crisis.
Five ways GAD can help us get through COVID. We're going through a difficult time. We're worried about a hidden killer. We're worried about inept leadership. There's always a hidden killer in a good mystery, but that killer gets exposed and vanquished, and the leadership, the detective, is always effective and brilliant at doing so. So I think losing ourselves in a mystery helps us kind of look at this whole thing from a metaphorical point of view. And it's a successful moment that we can kind of distract ourselves from the lack of success we're witnessing right now. Reason number one, if you think you've got it bad stuck in a house, think about what happens when the folks in a country house mystery get on each other's nerves, especially when the bridge is washed out or the ferry boat's not coming back. Think of all the incredible houses in detective fiction where terrible things happen. And watch that going on while you're reading your book and think about, you know, maybe playing Monopoly with the kids every night isn't so bad.
This idea of being locked up with a killer certainly does make being locked up with the family, and I guess potentially a killer, depending on how those Monopoly games go, right? It certainly does cast it in a new light, doesn't it? I suppose the classic example in this case is obviously And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie.
Absolutely.
The gold standard of being mired somewhere with a bunch of people you don't necessarily want to be with.
Well, don't you think that even if a person hates a mystery, that's the mystery they should read?
I think it's a great way of gauging if somebody is interested in mystery fiction. Yeah. It's not, there are many things it doesn't do. It's obviously, it's not detective fiction. It's not detection.
In a way, it's more of a novel. So in a sense, it's a better transition for a non-mystery reader. Let me say this about And Then There Were None. And then we won't talk about it anymore, because you could talk about this for days and people have. This is not the first time someone has written a book about a bunch of people trapped in a house getting killed off one by one. Everyone talks about how she took a lot of the same ideas from Gwen Bristow's Invisible Host, or whatever that's called. And that's true. And then how many books have we seen where 10 people are trapped in a house and they say in the spirit of Agatha Christie? But she does more with it. She talks about, she shows the emotional breakdown of a group of people. She really explains the motivation of the person, why they did this. In fact, she does that from their point of view rather than having anyone uncover it. In a sense, the fact that it's not a traditional detective story makes it more than just a genre book. Yeah. But as an example of how bad it can get to be on an island with a bunch of people in a beautiful house, and that house isn't old and creaky, it's beautiful. Mm. It's a great way to get over your own problems when you're stuck inside. But there are lots and lots and lots of books about people in country houses. I'm sure you have some favorites that you like to talk about.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of An Impossible Crime. And after brainstorming a few ideas about this, I was disturbed to realize that most of what I come up with are impossible crime novels. For instance, Haig Talbot's first novel, The Hangman's Handyman, which effectively is And Then There Were None, I suppose, on a much smaller scale, because not everybody dies, but it is a group of people isolated on a small island. They're only there, I think, for one night. The first half of that book is an amazingly atmospheric piece of writing, because they arrive at the house, all the lights have gone out, they can't get the electricity up, so everything is cast in candlelight, and Talbot writes this gorgeous way in which the candle obviously only lights the center of the room, and you really feel the shadows creeping in around the edges of the room as this talk of curses and people dying and magically rotting bodies sort of creeps in.
Yummy.
Oh, it's great. It's wonderful. And I think that's the key thing with this kind of book. Like, you want to feel that there isn't any escape. I think this is particularly the type of novel we're talking about here, where, you know, Murder on the Orient Express arguably might fit into one of these, to go back to Christie. The train is snowbound. Technically, they could, I suppose, leave the train and walk off.
In terms of houses, you know, Christie didn't really, she did do some house mysteries, but most of her house mysteries are about very unpleasant families trapped together. Hmm. I'm thinking of Christiana Brand, who excelled at the house mystery where people were more like we are. They were happy people. They were families. They were close friends, families. You know, she spends a great deal of time in her mysteries, like Suddenly at His Residence and Fog of Doubt, or what do you call it in London?
London in particular.
London in particular, where they're nice people, and she makes you see how lovely they are. And then she always ends that chapter saying, see, these wonderful people. Two of them are going to be dead in about 300 pages, and one of them will have killed them all. And I'm like, this disturbs me. This is wonderful. But then it all works out, you know, in the end. So she's a great one for the country house mystery. So is Nao Marsh. I know a lot of people, we all give a hard time to Nao Marsh, but she was great at houses, both in the city and the village, where great groups of people are dealing with their own neuroses and problems. Death and the Dancing Footman, and I think there's a host there who conducts a very fiendish psychological experiment on his guests, which is a terrible thing to do in a time of crisis. People shouldn't do that. And if you read that book, you'll know not to do that at your own homes with your own families.
The Country House Mystery, though, isn't necessarily the same principle as And Then There Were None, right? Because they're not trapped in that. I mean, psychologically, and I suppose from the perspective of never really being able to escape the events, they are trapped in the house, or they're trapped in the larger murder mystery. But they're not physically constrained to the location. Anybody could at any point in the middle of a country house mystery just walk out.
That's true. I suppose that the inspector usually says, you're all sticking around, or you give me your address. You know, in three-act tragedy, they all meet at Bartholomew Strange's house and he dies, and then they all get to go back to their lives, but it just gives people a chance to travel around and interview them.
Yeah.
The other thing when we're talking about this category was that houses themselves are so interesting. I'm thinking about, you know, right now I think a lot of people are using this time in their lockdowns to do like fix it up projects, clean out those cupboards in the kitchen, or take that room that, you know, Junior moved out to go to college. And now he's back and he doesn't want to live in a sewing room anymore. So now what do we do? And everyone's doing this kind of stuff. And what do you do when that room is the room where every 50 years a person goes in and gets murdered? You know, I'm thinking of Carter Dixon's The Red Widow Murders, which I love, and lots of books where there's a cursed room.
Helen McCloy, Mr. Splitfoot.
Yes, I love Mr. Splitfoot. Yeah. Paul Holter's The Madman's Room.
Mm-hmm.
And all those wonderful houses in Japanese honkaku fiction.
I remember someone, it wasn't me, using the phrase that it's an idea of concrete relational geography, about having a real good sense of the physical space in which these mysteries take place. And I often feel that the most impactful of these are ones where you do have a really good sense of, you know, not necessarily the layout of the house, because the layout of the house is important per se, but an idea of the layout of the house, because then you know what it feels like to move around inside those rooms. The Roger Scarlett books that were recently republished by Coachwick with Curtis Evans' introductions were brilliant examples of these. They're these five mansion mysteries. And in every single one of them, you have a really, really good idea, just a real good sense, the feeling of the walls of these old Bostonian mansions. And I think they're particularly effective because you understand the setting so well. And there's that sense where something can be quite familiar, but also be very threatening, which is, I guess, something that turns up quite a lot in horror fiction as well. I don't really read or watch enough to know. But I often wonder if the most successful of these aren't so much based around the people involved. I mean, my favorite Marsh book is my favorite Naomi Marsh book because she kills the best character probably she's ever written, and I've never forgiven her for that. But I think possibly the best country house mysteries are probably the one where you have a sense of the house as an intrinsic thing in itself.
Yes. I just finished, you know, first of all, I own four of the Roger Scarlets. I've read all five of your reviews. I've only read the first Roger Scarlet. I didn't love it, but I understand what you mean. And the one where the two brothers live in the parallel houses, that's yep. The one that's everyone, I know Curtis was really raving about that, so I'm looking forward to that one. I just did finish The Inugami Curse, and I think I posted that I really wish there was a map, but you don't need a map, because one of the things that that book does so well is gives you a sense of this kind of dark maze-like quality. The house is like, we have a house in just south of me called the Winchester Mystery House. Mrs. Winchester thought if she kept building the house, she'd live forever. And so there are rooms after rooms after rooms. Mm. And because this family is so dysfunctional, the patriarch just kept building out so that people could have their own little wing. And nothing makes sense. I could not really see it, but boy, could I feel that house. I could feel why dark things would happen in that house, because it was a house built out of hate and things like that, you know. Houses are great.
Houses are great. Houses are great. I suppose technically as well, this kind of thing also extends to not necessarily house mysteries, but I suppose you have your boat mysteries, where you have a group of people similarly, I guess, almost literally marooned in a boat or trapped in a boat for the duration of a voyage.
Well, that kind of brings us to reason number two, because, you know, just because the cruise industry has been hit so hard, I think when I was contemplating this, the first reason to read this or to read anything that came to me was, how else are you going to travel? Your cruise might have been canceled, but think about all those sleuths that got stuck on a ocean liner. And you know, I think that's rule number one with detective fiction: never travel with Charlie Chan or Miss Marple or Henry Merivale, because if you do, your life expectancy goes down by about 5 years.
Oh yeah, probably more.
Maybe more. Mm. So travel mysteries are always wonderful.
I wonder sometimes with the slight disadvantage I almost feel that a travel mystery has over a, say, like the country house mysteries, is certainly when you're in foreign climes, it almost feels like a lot more effort has to go on establishing your setting. So I think of something like Murder on Safari by Elsbeth Huxley, which is actually a superbly written book. The murder mystery element of it is perhaps slightly diluted, but it is a gorgeous book, and it a very evocative sense of what it is to be out in these incredible African plains and surrounded by all this, at the time, it would have been increasingly bizarre flora and fauna. Or something even like Dead Men Don't Ski by Patricia Moyes, which again has a very clever murder mystery plot, but has to spend quite a lot of time explaining the general setup of a skiing lodge.
Huxley did spend a lot of time in Africa, didn't she?
Yeah, apparently, yeah, she did. I mean, she wrote at least a couple of books out there.
Yeah, I have two of them that I have not read. They're on that pile I was mentioning earlier. But I did, years ago, read all of Patricia Moyes, and I know she loved skiing. She loved the snow. She loved France and Switzerland and all those areas. So that comes into her stories. Just as, you know, Christy wrote a lot of travel books, but I've never thought of her as the best purveyor of the atmosphere of the place, although she sets a lot of her books in the Middle East and knew the Middle East extremely well. Yeah, Murder in Mesopotamia, which has lots of problems that we don't have to discuss, what it does have is a wonderful rendering of a tell, you know, in Iran, and she does that really well. But I always find what's interesting about Christie, and maybe a lot of other British writers, is the desire to maintain that British atmosphere, that British community, shielded from the outside, the exotic outside world that we really want to hear more about, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. So do you think you're getting a better sense of a place then by reading books written by authors from those places? So for instance, Locked Room International have brought us a lot of stuff from France and from Japan and surrounds. Do you think if English authors or British authors are giving a really good sense of that almost sealed in aspic British mystery convention, do you think if we want to get a good sense of Japan, we've got to read a Japanese mystery? If we want to get a good sense of Italy, you've got to read an Italian mystery?
Well, the first, you say this and it strikes me for the first time that there are two ways to think about travel. When I go to Japan with a honkaku mystery, I'm not traveling on a boat, but I do feel like I am being lifted out of myself into a completely different culture, and I find that fascinating. But I also think it's fun just to travel. I mean, you go on the Orient Express. I don't remember if they go anywhere. I guess they're kind of traveling through Turkey, but that's really all about being on the train.
Yeah.
Or, you know, those people that go on cruises, sure, they go on, they step off the boat and go and look at places. But isn't most of it about being on the boat itself?
Well, but then I guess Death on the Nile, I mean, it doesn't quite take place as much on land as it does on the boat. But certainly there's a significant elements of that book that occur not on the boat as much as on the boat, right?
Some of the best parts, traveling through some of those ruins, it's wonderful.
Yeah, as you say, there are these, broadly, these two kinds of travel mystery. One which is about the traveling and what occurs on the journey. So, I don't know, Nine and Death Makes Ten by Carter Dixon, or those like the Huxley, like the Moyes title, where you are already at your destination, or your Honkaku novels where you started at the destination, so there was no traveling involved. Death on the Nile sort of eats its cake and has it too, doesn't it? Because you both have the restriction of the geography of the boat, but they also get off at Petra and they go and look around at ruins, and the aspect of being in Egypt as much as being on the boat.
That's right.
Do you think that might be part of why that book is so highly regarded? Because it's effectively kind of subtly managing to shake up the kind of travel mystery that I guess people are used to writing or reading?
Honestly, no. I think it's highly regarded because, although you and I have disagreed on this, it's got this wonderful central triangle that kind of branches out into a really cool mystery. And to the extent that the boat provides a long passenger list, so there can be all kinds of subtle, you know, or not so subtle red herrings going on in that sense. But I'm sure people also felt a sort of a thrill getting on a steamer going down the Nile. I'm sure most of the people who were reading Christie's book in 1937 had not been on a steamer going down the Nile. So that gave them a little bit of a taste of that. Mm. You know, she was on the Orient Express in the early 30s. So she's sharing that aspect of it with us.
One of the things a bit like that I find most fascinating is culturally what it reveals about the time these things were written as well. Like, as much as you can look into a life which, yeah, is potentially beyond our paychecks. I love how, for instance, the Ginza Ghost Collection by Keikichi Osaka that Locrium International put out captures what feels like a very specific point in Japanese history, where you've got this moving from sort of old non-technological ways and society into a slightly more technologically advanced and dependent society. And there's a certain idea I love of how you can learn so much about somewhere that you've never been by reading these books. And as you say, we also get the advantage of there being a nice plot where somebody gets murdered and we get some mental, if not physical, exercise along the way.
I will tell you, without a doubt, reading Agatha Christie starting at the age of 11, as much as I did, and then following it up with Carr and Brand, that's what made me an Anglophile. That's what led me to read Dickens and Austen. The feeling of what it was like to live an English life, which may have been completely prosaic and not realistic compared to how you all grew up, I don't know. But that's what made me want to go to England.
What's our third reason then? What do we got?
Well, I was inspired with this reason from the mom in my drama department who designs our costumes. She sent her son over to my house about a month ago with a mask, beautiful purple mask that she had made for me. And I wear it quite proudly. And I started to think about all the masks that people wear in mysteries, literal masks and figurative masks. Disguise, dishonesty, all of those things are a vital part of a murder mystery. So reason number three is, are you looking for inspiration for just the right mask to wear? Mysteries are where you find all the best disguises. Since the days of Sherlock Holmes, both criminals and detectives have used masks, makeup, and other disguises to fool each other. And there are so many examples, some of them wonderful, some of them absolutely ridiculous. And I can find wonderful and ridiculous from the same author. So go for it.
Let's have some fun and start with a ridiculous one.
I may be stretching the idea of disguise, but Murder in Mesopotamia has a character who is in disguise. It has actually more than one who is in disguise. And the major disguise is absolutely ludicrous, because there is no way that this disguise should fool the main person in question. And I can't say more without blowing it, but every single person who has read Murder in Mesopotamia knows exactly what I'm talking about. There's a minor disguise, there's someone who's faking being something that they're not. But in this case, this person, this should not work. And yet, Christie lets it work because it has to. Otherwise, the mystery doesn't evolve.
I don't wish to cite specific examples. I think you're right. It's probably best to try and stay away from spoilers. The principle of disguise that irritates me the most is the, well, nobody ever looks at an X thing.
I knew it.
It frustrates me so much. There is a book, which is fundamentally a very good book, that relies on, well, nobody ever looks at menial workers, or nobody at a fairground ever considers the person of this profession. And it annoys me so much. There is a G.K. Chesterton story, which is probably the most famous and probably the most irritating example of it, where I suppose this might be a principle of the cult that I was talking about before, that idea of it being so nice to visit the culture of a time. This is one of those things that you're just going to have to accept. But this idea that we never consider menial workers. And so therefore we're going to say, well, no, nobody approached the table when very obviously a waiter did approach the table, or nobody was in this shop when very clearly somebody stacking the shelves was in the shop. Although I suppose appropriately on the back of the COVID pandemic and the key workers being used to effectively prop up economies and to keep communities working, maybe this principle will be retired once and for all, because no one's ever going to ignore a key worker ever again. But I find it as a principle immensely, immensely annoying when that is how something gets resolved.
I hear you. Agatha Christie did it 100,000 times. I think she does it a little kind of cleverly in Death in the Clouds. But even so, you have to start in those books with the premise that there is a group of people in the world that don't really matter. They're quite unnecessary to look at because they just do things for us. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very difficult thing to embrace. I'm going to mention the name of one of the best books to use a disguise. But I'm going to let you talk about it because you really deserve to talk about it. It's one mm-hmm. of my favorites, but you deserve to talk about it. And that is The Problem of the Green Capsule, or The Black Spectacles. That is a brilliant use of disguise.
The thing that's so lovely about it is that it's so obviously a use of disguise. The principle being this poisoning effectively takes place that is committed by a man everybody sees, or a woman everybody sees, dressed up deliberately in this ridiculous outfit with their hands obscured, with their face obscured. You can't see any part of them because they're so elaborately overdressed. And the way that spins out is so much more rewarding than a novel where it goes, oh, but I thought that was Peter, and it wasn't Peter, it was somebody made up to look like Peter, and what a surprising piece of disguise. Carr, you know, part of the reason Carr, I think, is still so discussed among people into their mystery fiction is because he could take these principles and exploit them so well from what should be really quite trashy beginnings, you know, to go, well, this is so obviously a disguise. It's so blatantly and so flagrantly a disguise. There shouldn't be anything interesting that you can do with that. But he turns it into this wonderful multifaceted mystery. He does a similar sort of thing in The Unicorn Murders, where you know that there is a character who is misrepresenting themselves. You're told by your detective that there is a character there who is misrepresenting themselves.
New characters.
Oh, good point. And it should be, again, this really hoary, well, you're the master thief. No, you're the master thief. Well, maybe he's the master thief. But again, he just plays with it in a way that, for some reason, very few people ever really figured out. I also like, I guess there's an element of disguise in it, but those stories where there is something very distinctive about the killer's outfit or the killer's clothing, like 9 Times 9 by Anthony Boucher, for instance, where you have this religious leader who dresses in a very distinctive bright yellow robe. Or I suppose more modern examples would be the likes of the Scream movies, the Wes Craven directed Scream movies, where you have your ghost face killers in their masks and their very long flowing black robes. You know, I don't think anybody sees a distinctive costume now and believes it's always the same person inside of that costume. I think we can say that broadly without it being a spoiler. But I think mystery fiction got to a point where it had to embrace the disguise in a way that is very visually compelling when written in words, right? Because you can show somebody being well disguised or poorly disguised in a TV show or in a movie. I always think of Sherlock Holmes and how brilliant he's supposed to be at disguise. There was an original script of a Sherlock Holmes story a few years ago starring Rupert Everett as Holmes. And towards the end, Rupert Everett's Holmes is disguised as someone and peels off the disguise like a bad guy in Scooby-Doo to reveal, oh my God, how surprising, Sherlock Holmes has been here the whole time. Except that it's really obviously Rupert Everett in disguise. And so you can write, well, Holmes was a master of disguise, but once principles of makeup, and I imagine as films and certainly color films started to come in and become more popular, I wonder if readers got less credulous about how possible it is to just be told that somebody had disguised themselves well. And so the disguises had to be your problem of the green capsule, where it's someone so dressed up in this ridiculous outfit, or it had to be 9x9, where it's a very visually striking, bright yellow, long robe, long sleeves, hood over the head, something very simple and very compelling, because that was the response to, I suppose, an understanding that the idea of just putting a couple of cotton wool pads in your cheekbones and drawing a beard on is just ridiculous and is not going to work.
Well, a couple of thoughts about movies. Have you seen the 60s film adaptation of Philip McDonald's The List of Adrian Messenger?
No.
Oh, so good. So, you know, this is a serial killer is killing a lot of different people, and you see that this person is wearing a variety of disguises through the whole thing. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is that the killer is played by a very famous Hollywood actor. So they hired about half a dozen Hollywood actors, famous male Hollywood actors, to put on disguises and play a variety of cameos for the whole thing. So through the whole movie, you see these people in this inordinate mask-like makeup. I mean, these are not like a couple of pads and some makeup. This is a complete rubber mask. And they're playing all kinds of different characters. And you're like, that person, I saw a person with that person. And they're not. And at the very end, they get to all kind of reveal who they really are. And it's wonderful. I mean, it's not a great mystery, but it's a great movie. I highly recommend that.
I've just had a thought that is nothing to do with what you've said. So I apologize if this appears like I wasn't listening. But I'm just thinking about the evolution of disguise and how if we're thinking originally of going, oh, well, Holmes put on a fake mustache and he was perfectly disguised. And you go, well, that becomes ridiculous. And so the disguise has to become more technicolor. I was thinking about the idea then of disguise in narrative evolving in something like Ira Levin's A Kiss Before Dying, where, as you say, in Adrian Messenger, what you have is lots of different people wearing different disguises. What we have in A Kiss Before Dying is the author deliberately disguising their killer. And part of me just wonders if this is emblematic of the way in which crime fiction or mystery fiction has developed. Like, originally we're told, yeah, makeup's good enough, some fake eyebrows, a fake beard. And then we go, well, I don't believe that anymore. So you go, okay, well, so now I need this costume. Well, okay, well, costumes suddenly don't seem to work anymore. We grow through that awareness of the costume. So now I, as a writer, must do more to a clue what's going on to disguise my killer. And obviously then from there, from your, I mean, Kiss Before Dying is that third person omniscient narration. But then from there, you go into your first person unreliable narrator, obviously, which we've seen to death. I mean, we saw elements of that in the Golden Age, of course, but that's almost become a trope in itself now. Where are we in the early 21st century? Is that a fair summation of the progression of disguise through mystery fiction?
I think there's a trick you can get away with in literature that goes beyond just the wearing of a mask. Mm. My favorite Christie, again, we talk about disguise, it's hard not to spoil. I won't say the name of any murderers, but I'll mention two of my favorite mysteries. One of them is After the Funeral by Agatha Christie, and that involves disguise. And one of the coolest things about that, and a lot of people who really examine that book talk about it, and that is that an old woman comes to her brother's funeral, and nobody has seen anybody for years, so they don't know each other very well. And that's the justification for a disguise working. And the old woman basically says, you know, her brother has visited her in the past, and so it's quite clear he's been murdered. And she throws that out, and then the whole book is the repercussions of that, and that woman gets killed. And that's lovely, and could that disguise really work? I don't know. But there's a wonderful moment that's like the Bud thing that you were talking about, and that is that right after the funeral, Christie follows each family member away from, you know, back toward their home, and she stops in a little tea shop where a little old lady in Black Mourning is talking about what a great thing she did by throwing that bombshell out. And you make assumptions based on the writing. And you know what who you're talking to or who you're watching here. And she fools you because she can, because it's literature. And she can't have that scene. You can't have that scene in a movie adaptation.
I've just finished reading, on the subject of books that involve disguise, I've just finished reading The Invisible Circle by Paul Altair. I should say I'm rereading it because it was one of the Altair novels I read before I started blogging. And rereading it is a fascinating experience because you can see it from the author's perspective of the various tricks that he is playing on the reader. I love that. I love the having reread it, and this is what I said last week, I almost enjoy it more for how fully Altair commits to that very classical era of trick, but updates it by, well, ways and means. I think we should get into it because we're going to...
I got you. Well, you'll cut this whole segment and I'll feel sad, but it's probably for the best. People hate being spoiled. I agree with that. I totally agree. And I spoil all the time.
Okay. What is reason number four?
Well, reason number four is that, you know, we're all so anxious to get back into the swing of things, get back into the crowd. But as Golden Age detective fiction has shown us, crowds aren't all that safe anyway. From department stores to football stadiums, there isn't a public space where murder hasn't been committed. The theaters, the schools, the penguin aquariums. Thank you, Stuart Palmer. There are so many places you can go and find your own, you'll find a dead body. So I don't see why we shouldn't just stay at home and be safe from those public murderers.
People will know I am not a fan of early Ellery Queen style of writing, but I do think one of the things they did really well was show or utilize, is perhaps a better word, the possibilities of these very public, supposedly safe and secure spaces, the theater, the department store, the operating table. You know, for me, what really came out of that early era Ellery Queen stuff was not so much what they contributed in terms of plotting or in terms of writing, but very much what they contributed in terms of the milieu in which the mystery could then move into and operate and function.
They were two young men who were emulating a kind of tired older man, S.S. Van Dyne. Almost all of S.S. Van Dyne's are brownstone mysteries of some kind. Not all of them, but most of them. They were experimenting, you know? I understand that nowadays their prose is stilted and things go on too long and maybe it's a little too convoluted. The characters are wooden, at least in the first period. But yeah, there was some really wonderful chances they took. You know, a bunch of people excited about the display at French's department store, except it happens to be the dead body of Mrs. French. That's fun. The American Gun Mystery takes place at a rodeo, and it's kind of cool because the actual rodeo act and the setup of the whole rodeo is integral to the murderer's plot. They did some great stuff in wide open spaces.
As you say, if Van Dyne was quite tired and quite old, there was a risk that the mystery story might have ended up just mired in these British country houses or whatever equivalent British country house British authors were putting in Mesopotamia or in Egypt or in Iraq or in wherever. But I feel like there was that real sort of invigoration, I suppose, of the possibilities, which might be partly why those mysteries remain so popular, you know, even now, even, I mean, you know, with, what are we, 91 years on from Roman Hat Mystery?
Well, I do think that, you know, your typical classic mystery does take place in an enclosed space. Even a village is enclosed. You know, you have a very finite area. So for me, since all things lead back to Christy, Queen, and Carr, you've mentioned Ellery Queen. For Christy, and I every day I feel worse about the fact that I did not include this book in my top 10. But the ABC murders does such a great job of taking that enclosed mystery, that closed circle mystery, and turning it into this wide open thing. You know, a woman is killed on a beach. A man is killed in a ravine. A guy is stabbed in a theater. And that scene toward the end, before the theater stabbing, where they're like at the races and they're seeking, trying to find the serial killer in this wide open space with millions of people. It's very exciting. And it's different for Christie. And so that's why it stands out. And for Carr, the book that I loved so much, and it surprised me how much I would love it, was The Punch and Judy Murders. Because that is, not only does it turn out to be one of his best solutions, I mean, it's a real nice, nice punch at the end of The Punch and Judy Murders, but it is the greatest romp.
Yeah,
it's the series of train rides and running through houses, and it's like the best of Hitchcock meets classic mystery, and I love that book. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I don't think The Punch and Judy Murders gets enough love. It's an absolutely brilliant book. It's a brilliant book. I find it interesting that one of the most commonly cited examples of this murder in public stories is also one of the most commonly unacknowledged failures of the detective novel in Josephine Tay's The Man in the Queue. The setup there sees effectively a man, spoilers, in a queue outside of a theater get stabbed, and it falls to a series detective, Alan Grant, to try to figure out who he is and who could have killed him. The idea that the murder itself is very easy, to semi-borrow a phrase from Dame Agatha, but the detection is incredibly difficult. And it's a real shame that in terms of cluing and in terms of detection, in terms of plot progression, I'm aware this is not a book you've read. It's such an interesting setup, but it turns out to be, I mean, it's really barely a detective novel at all. It's barely anything where those principles that are observed matter, shall we say, come the end. I'll give you an example. I don't know if it's going to spoil anything. I've just read Sleeping Murder, and that book is, you know, it's reasonably well written, but she gets to the end and she just suddenly realizes who the killer is. And all of the detection, you know, and like the principles of detection are reasonably well observed in that book. But none of it matters. There's nothing that they establish that in any way dismisses anybody from consideration. By pure chance, she happens to be in the corridor wearing, you know, where the murder took place. She just happens to have put on the gloves that the murderer was wearing when the murderer just happens to walk in. And so she has that connection with the sight of the gloves and the sound of his voice. And you go, that entire book could have been cut down to a short story.
It's a real puzzler, because I know that originally everyone thought it was written around the same time as Curtain. So that would be like during World War II. I think there's been some rumbling that it was written much later. I don't know.
She makes reference to it. There are papers I was reading about. John Curran found papers where she is referring to it and like the rights and what happens to it around like the early 40s.
So if it's that case, it's kind of understandable. In the early 40s, in 42, she'd only written one or two books with Miss Marple in them. So I'm sure she didn't feel quite the same way about Miss Marple as she felt about Poirot. She certainly didn't know that Marple would have the same kind of legacy. It seems like such a minor book. Mm. The characters are far less interesting than they are in even Murder at the Vicarage. If it was written after Body in the Library, even more so. They're just, they don't come to life, they're sticks. That was another book where she uses an epigraph. That epigraph meant something to me from my studies at school, so I knew who the killer was immediately. And I just sort of sat there through interviews and not much more, waiting for that to be revealed, and it was. So I get your frustration. It's like, there's no trick to the fact that Gwenda is in that house.
No.
It's just, and when it's just coincidence, it doesn't matter. If someone had lured her there, if there'd been some powerful thing.
Yeah, some sort of secret, yeah. Mysteries in Crowds, what do you got?
What have I got for Mysteries in Crowds? Let me see. Well, there's a lot of theater stuff, and we don't have to get into all the theater stuff. I think Death of Jezebel by Christiana Brandt is a classy public murder. And by extension, our friend James and his opening night murder, James Burnside, he carries on that tradition quite well. That's what I got.
There's a J.V. Turner novel called Below the Clock, which is a murder in the Houses of Parliament. which is very interesting, actually. I read it at a point where I had a lot of reviews already stacked and ready to go, so I didn't really have room to fit it in anywhere. But it's a very interesting, and again, harks back to that Ellery Queen idea of, is there anything that's supposedly sacrosanct in terms of where a murder, and indeed part of the narrative of that book is this shocked response by the members of Parliament. This is the Houses of Parliament, you know, the murder shouldn't be happening here. And I love this extension that you can't really go anywhere. You know, obviously impossible crimes prove that you're certainly not safe on your own in a locked room. And as you increase the size of the room and as you increase the number of people who are present, you obviously don't increase the safety. I think that's a very salutary lesson, if a slightly weird one.
Margaret Truman used her antecedents, her family connections to write a series of mysteries set in every major public space in Washington, D.C. I haven't read them, but I'm sure they were fun. And I just want to give a shout out to Alfred Hitchcock, who, while he was not a fan of the whodunit, was very much a fan of setting murders in public places. And they account for some of the best scenes in his work. From the murder, the execution of a murderer on the top of the Statue of Liberty in front of a crowd, to the wonderful, iconic scene in the middle of nowhere in North by Northwest where the crop duster attacks Cary Grant. He really could show how places that we trust as safe places where we can all gather can turn into a nightmare. The United Nations again in North by Northwest.
I was going to say the United Nations scene is the one that really captures that for me, because obviously he's using the suspicion of the crowd against Cary Grant's character so well. Theoretically, if you are one person found on your own in a room with a dead body, you are not safe from suspicion. If you're found in the middle of a crowd of the dead body, you should be safe from suspicion. This is the idea. There are so many other people around, it should obviously be so much more safe. And that United Nations murder is just exquisite for how it shows, well, no, because the immediate way in which the suspicion is heightened by all of the people around you is just gorgeous cinema. Gorgeous cinema.
It is. It's wonderful. I don't want to rush us to the next one, but we probably should so we can cover it to a little bit. It's kind of dear to my heart because I, as an instructor, and you as an instructor, have had to engage in distance learning, distance teaching. I, who crave the classroom and the camaraderie of students and teachers in real life, have had a particularly challenging time trying to figure out how to teach a creative art subject like drama over the internet. But it did bring up for me an idea for a final reason that mysteries can teach you the appropriate method of distance learning. Although sometimes people who either look out their windows or overhear a conversation they were not meant to hear get more than they bargained for. And I do think that there's some wonderful mysteries where just such a thing happens. Someone looks out their window at home or another window and sees something they shouldn't, or hears a conversation that leads to all kinds of perfidy.
Given that we've just been talking about films, if you have not seen the Francis Ford Coppola movie, The Conversation, starring Gene Hackman, it is a beautiful example of this exact principle. He is a recording expert who is asked to record a conversation between some people who are not going to be stationary, sat in a room. They're a couple of men who want to have a conversation in what they believe is a safe space in public, in fact, as it happens, wandering around. And so he has this surveillance challenge of how can they record the conversation. But I'm sure we'll get on to discuss instances where someone accidentally overhears something. But the beauty of this is that he is obviously deliberately overhearing something. And inside of this, even though you know that there's going to be something about this conversation which is the core of whatever mystery is happening around him, I don't want to spoil it, the way in which that is revealed, the way in which that unfolds in that film is just, again, just magnificently handled. One of those instances where, again, you really have to see it on the screen, where there's that real advantage of moving pictures matched up to sound to communicate something which in text you're simply never going to get and never going to believe.
I own the movie. I've shown it to my film class. There are two things. One of them is that I love how he's a detective piecing together the snippets of conversation, and each snippet leads him into a different direction. So you see certain things played out over and over in different ways with added information, just like a detective would do. And the other aspect of it is that, boy, is there a movie that's more prescient for our modern times, where everything we do is being watched or listened to? The idea of privacy, we're talking on a Zoom meeting right now, and there have been all kinds of controversies regarding Zoom and what people can do, and people have been Zoom bombed and whatever, new verbs appear in our vocabulary. So the conversation all the way back in the 70s was showing something that has not gotten better. It has gotten more pervasive and even worse in that we no longer care so much. Coppola's saying, hey folks, watch out. And we paid no attention to that. And that movie really shows the consequences of that. You're right, it's a brilliant film. The other film I would say that you need to watch is, first listen to the radio play and then watch the movie of Sorry, Wrong Number. Because again, that shows, here's a woman who is isolated at home, and part of it is on her own, she wants to be. She wants her husband to be by her side. So she's an invalid with a very mysterious disease. And she's trying to reach him at work, say, why aren't you home yet? And her wires get crossed, and she overhears two men having a conversation like, yeah, so the murder's going to take place at 11. Yeah, I'll get into the house and then we'll kill her. We'll make sure that our client is satisfied. And she's like, oh my God, a murder. So she's calling the police. She's calling. Nobody believes her. And it spills out from there. And it's sheer genius. The original radio play with Agnes Moorehead is must listen history. The movie with Barbara Stanwyck maybe pads it out a little bit too long, but it's still very good.
Also, since we're on movies, Rear Window.
My favorite movie of all time. It's the movie about be careful what you see. Be careful when you're bored. You're isolated because of a broken leg or COVID-19. You're like, I'll watch The Neighbors. Why not? What could go wrong? And we could have a 10-hour Zoom meeting about Rear Window. I love that movie. You're right. And the story's good, but the movie is brilliant because he's talking about people who don't lead full, rich enough lives to prevent themselves from butting in where they don't belong. Because even though he may be right, his neighbor may be a killer and may require some justice, there's still a sense that he's guilty of something too. Movies lend themselves to this because they're visual and they're aural, but there are a lot of examples in literature of people overhearing or eavesdropping or viewing something. For me, I think when that becomes sort of the starting point, it's great. In Christie, the par excellence example is 450 from Paddington, where Mrs. McGillicuddy's traveling to visit her friend Jane Marple in a train and sees a murder by looking through the window. It's an accident. She's not eavesdropping. It just happens. And it leads into a delightful mystery. For Appointment with Death, the very first sentence is an overheard snippet of conversation. You do see, don't you, that she's got to be killed. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it leads as richly into anything afterwards. We find out right away who said it. We're not sure till the very end whether that really means anything, but it is Hercule Poirot who hears it, and it will remind him of some things when he gets into investigating a murder later on. But there are some great examples of viewing or listening to things. Mm-hmm. Carr does it. There's an early Colonel March story, one of the first, where someone looks across through a window and sees a man being murdered, I think by a disguised figure.
It's a pair of disembodied hands, isn't it? Pick up a gun.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And it doesn't lend itself to as, it's a better premise than it is a solution. But and then the one that we probably disagree a little bit about, or I know I do with others, is I wanted to love the Emperor Snuffbox. Mm. And I didn't because the solution was so apparent to me from the start. I was not fooled. I just wouldn't go along with it. And that's, you know, when that happens, as you know, because it's happened to you, it lessens the impact of a book. And it's a wonderful book, but I just knew from the start what was going on, and it bothered me. Isn't it sad? The five reasons include many reasons that we can't talk about.
This is, unfortunately, this is getting into specifics of Golden Age detection, isn't it? It's,
Yeah.
This is the difficulty that we have. The alternative is we just give out a 37 book reading list before every single episode. And then no one would listen to it. I mean, no one listens to it anyway, but you know. So hopefully there's something in there which is useful to someone. I know people are having a tremendously hard time coping with this. And we all want to escape into the things that are meaningful to us. You know, we're being semi-frivolous in suggesting this is going to get you through the COVID pandemic, obviously, but hopefully there is something in there that you can connect with.
I do think it actually got many people through two world wars, at least helped. I freely admit that reading lighthearted material is harder for me now than usual. Mm. And I have the time. So I recognize that we are distracted. But I do think that looking at anything lightheartedly is a help. And I do think that for me, these old mysteries, even the ones that I haven't read before, it's like visiting old friends, going to a more comfortable time. And really, the time we're talking about was a time when the world was in turmoil, and yet the books themselves create a sense of calm and of problems that can be solved. And those problems can be crazy, but we solve them, or at least Gideon Fell solves them, and we are grateful. And then we can all watch the people who are left over pair up and live happily ever after. And I think we all need a little bit of that right now because we're all so uncertain about what's going on.
I think that's very well put. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. This has been great.
I've had a great time, as always.
We will do it again sometime, potentially while sat in the same room, but if not, we've found a way to make it work when we're not.
And I think I'm going to see you in a couple of months with our friend Moira, so I'm looking forward to that as well.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. All right. Brad, have a lovely day. Thanks very much indeed.
You too. Thanks.